From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are very grateful for that support. I was in Europe speaking at a conference earlier this month, and I want to mention something that surprised me. A number of people from different countries approached me at various times and told me they listen to this show. They value this show, and they appreciate what they hear on State of Belief. The reach of this program is greater than any of us can ever know, but it can only continue with your help. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, on Monday, the Supreme Court allowed a partial implementation of the president's controversial Muslim travel ban. Crucially, in doing so, the justices sidestepped addressing the central issue raised by the ban, religious discrimination, for now. An outpouring of voter outrage, sit-ins, protests, phone calls, rallies, and more likely made the difference in getting a temporary stay for the Republican Affordable Care Act death sentence. With enormous tax benefits for the top 1%, defunding of Planned Parenthood, and an outright assault on Medicaid, even one-party rule has not been enough to rush this monster bill through. Understanding that the fight is far from over, we can't forget that. A remarkable cross-section of interfaith leaders held a 23-hour vigil in the nation's capital this week to save health care in this country. The Interfaith Healthcare Coalition is promising to keep up the pressure when the Senate returns to this issue next month. And Kentucky Evangelical Governor Matt Bevin has signed a law allowing public school courses on the Bible. While supporters say this will help understand the principles our nation was founded on, opponents point out that other religions are not included. This is the same governor, remember, who urged roving student prayer groups as one solution to growing gun violence. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Shelley Moore Capito, a half dozen West Virginia residents, in an act of peaceful civil disobedience, they pledged to stay until she pledged to vote no on the Republicans' health care bill or until they get arrested, whichever came first. And this afternoon, they got arrested.
Determined to do their part to impose the death penalty on the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, Senate Republicans raced to the edge of the legislative cliff earlier this week and then screeched to a halt. Committed activists were out in force, often putting themselves physically on the line in an effort to be heard by their representatives. And that included faith leaders on this week's show. I'll talk to one of those leaders, West Virginia's Kaylin Parker.
We are Sikhs. Sikh Americans.
We believe in equality,
tolerance, and respect for all.
Because Sikh values are American values.
Followers of the Sikh faith have been the targets of over 300 reported hate crimes since 9/11. At the same time, a majority of Americans confess they know nothing at all about Sikhs and have never interacted with a Sikh. Now, an ambitious initiative to change that has been launched by the National Sikh Campaign, and we'll hear from Campaign Executive Director Gurwin Singh Ahuja. But first,
lawyers for the church school argued that the grant program was open to all not-for-profit schools except religious ones. Thus, they said religious schools were being treated worse than everyone else. And it turns out that the Supreme Court bought it.
The last few days of the Supreme Court session generated a lot of headlines this past week. While some of the cases the justices agreed to take up in the fall are notable, a Monday ruling on a somewhat esoteric case may resonate in the years and decades ahead in ways that are difficult to anticipate. An article on the decision in The Atlantic magazine was headlined, "A Major Church-State Ruling That Shouldn't Have Happened." And I'm happy to welcome the author of that piece, constitutional law professor Garrett Epps, to State of Belief Radio. Garrett, thanks for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with just a quick summary of Trinity versus Comer, please.
Well, Trinity Lutheran Church is a congregation in Columbia, Missouri, and they wanted to qualify for grants under a state program that would allow them to use recycled rubber tires to produce a sort of softer surface for their daycare playground. The church itself operates a daycare open to not just church members' children, but children in the community. Mm-hmm. But it is the church itself that runs it. It's more common to have a daycare that has a separate nonprofit with its own board. As a result of that organizational feature, the state of Missouri, pointing to its own constitution, said, we cannot give a grant that flows directly into the treasury of a church. There is a no funding provision in the Missouri Constitution, and as many as 38 other states have similar provisions that just says no state money can go directly to subsidize a church. You know, they were represented by advocacy groups that saw this as an opportunity to get rid of or weaken this state wall of separation, which is different and often stronger than the federal one. Mm-hmm. And the court's decision was that the church was entitled to compete for the grant, that the restriction on a church itself being eligible for these general grants was unconstitutional.
Garrett, you wrote that both the majority opinion and the leading dissent got the issue wrong. What do you mean by that?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, he characterized the case as saying that the state of Missouri wanted to discriminate against the church because of its religious identity. And he analogized it to a Maryland provision in the 19th century that said that Jews couldn't hold office. That's really not what was going on, because if the daycare center had had a separate board, had had its own treasury, mm-hmm. then they would certainly have been eligible. The fact that they're located in a church or that they have a religious identity under Missouri law, that would not have kept them from being eligible. So it isn't the church's religious identity, it's its form of organization. There's no discrimination against religion as such in the Missouri law. Now, Justice Sotomayor, who for herself and Justice Ginsburg wrote a scathing dissent, she took the position that for the church to receive this funding at all would violate the Establishment Clause. I myself think that's going a little far. There is a concept in constitutional law, in the law of church and state, that was created by Chief Justice Rehnquist, and that's called play in the joints. And what he says is, it can't be, it's just too unwieldy to have a position that says that everything that is not forbidden by the Establishment Clause is required by the Free Exercise Clause and vice versa. States have got to have a little leeway to have their own constitutions and their own systems and work this out through their political system, which, by the way, is what happened in Missouri. By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, it was no longer really a case. I frankly think the way to deal with it would have been to dismiss it, because at the last election, Missouri elected a new attorney general and a new governor, and both of these gentlemen had run for office on the explicit platform that they were going to reinterpret the Missouri Constitution in order to allow the funding to flow to the church. And that is, in fact, what happened. After their election, the state changed its regulations and said that under their reading of the Missouri Constitution, the church could compete for these. The church could get its grant. And so I think the court should have simply dismissed the case as moot. And I was distressed, it seemed to me, that a number of people on the right side of the court were eager to reach this issue, and they kind of refused to let go of this kind of Flying Dutchman of a case that really didn't belong in the courtroom.
So why did the high court not just throw it out?
I think there are at least three justices who are very eager. They have a long-term agenda of wanting to really weaken the existing precedents about separation of church and state. That's Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, and the newest justice, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote separately to say, as far as we're concerned, there can be no differentiation between churches and other nonprofit organizations, which was really not the issue presented in the court. But I think they're sending a signal to litigators below, bring us some more cases. You've got at least three votes in the bag here. And, of course, Justice Kennedy may retire soon. It's a very common practice of the Supreme Court justices to signal we want cases on this issue. And that's, I think, what was going on.
We certainly know that Gorsuch wants that horse to be ridden.
And, oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Well, look, let's do broaden it a little, Garrett. What could this ruling mean for other cases going forward?
Well, I think that churches, you know, are going to be emboldened to make certain demands for inclusion in government funding programs. And at the same time, there are going to be demands by some of these institutions. The legal term is houses of worship, because mm-hmm. obviously there are religions that don't call their congregations churches.
Right.
There are going to be demands by some of them that they be eligible for funds but exempt from certain regulations, particularly the regulations involving discrimination. And, of course, this is a very serious problem of conscience for a lot of religious people. There are people who think that including same-sex couples or gay and lesbian people or transgender people, that this is against their faith, mm-hmm. and they're taking a fairly aggressive position that they can't be required not to discriminate, and they should receive the funding. And there's a real tension there, because by tradition, government funding comes with certain conditions, and the questions the court has usually asked are simply, are the conditions reasonable, and are they related to the purpose of the grant, and so forth. And it's a worrisome development. One of the reasons that the framers of the First Amendment included a kind of hint that there's separation is because they saw religious issues as particularly divisive. These are the heirs of the Protestant Wars of the 17th century. And we're going to have a lot of really divisive disputes about this. Now, at the same time, you got to admit, anybody has to admit, that it is a searing problem for some of these religious traditions to be required to recognize what their theology tells them is sinful. My view, you know, you didn't entirely ask for it, but I'm going to give it to you. My view is that, as happened in Missouri, this ought to be worked out by the political process. This ought to be worked out by debates, the people's representatives, and so forth, in a civil way, which is how we determine the structure of exemptions in our federal civil rights laws. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a desire and a perception on the part of some to win these in court rather than as part of a debate, and I regret that. But that's just a forecast. I can't tell you that's what's going to happen.
Well, we have the information that came from the Hobby Lobby case and corporations now having religious freedom rights like individuals, we know that we're going down a pretty dangerous road that was traveled by people who said that they were against interracial marriage because of their faith. We're getting in a really complex situation where a person seems to be able to say, that's against my faith, and without any interest in how deep the faith is, whether this is an excuse or whether it really is a conviction, that person gets an out on some of these issues. So what insights do you have from that on what's likely to happen on these religion cases going forward?
There are twin guarantees in the religion clauses. There's the guarantee that the government will not establish a religion, and there's the guarantee that religious people will be given the free exercise of their religious beliefs. And those two guarantees have always been slightly in tension, because the more concessions you make for specifically religious behavior, the more you will be accused of establishing that religion. You know, why is it that Sabbatarians, for example, are exempt from certain unemployment laws, whereas people who just think they ought to have Saturday off are not? Isn't that establishment? And the rough truce that was reached over the years was that religious bodies get certain advantages, you know, beginning with freedom from taxation, but going forward, for example, that in certain kinds of hiring decisions, religious bodies can discriminate in favor of their own adherents. You know, if you're going to hire a custodian even for your church, you can say, we want a member of our church, which would be a violation for a secular corporation to do. So we're seeing two things, which is the first thing, as you noted, is that the number of organizations that now apparently hold free exercise rights is growing. In the Hobby Lobby case, the court said that closely held family corporations had a religious free exercise rights, even though they are for profit. That was a very novel holding. But if you look at legislation that's going on in the states, you'll see that they're increasingly guaranteeing free exercise rights to all for-profit corporations, regardless of whether they're closely held. You know, ExxonMobil will have the right to engage in certain kind of religious discrimination under some of these statutes, and they're even expanding, both the court and the statutes are expanding the free exercise rights to include government officials who, under some of these states, you know, a judge or a county clerk has a religious right to refuse government services to same-sex couples. And in a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway, you had a city government that was beginning each of its meetings with a sectarian prayer, by which it was a very specific denomination, almost always Christian, usually Catholic, that was addressed to the audience that had come to see their city government meet, and often said to them, you need to accept Jesus, you need to be a Christian, or you won't be saved. And the court was looking at an objection by some of the local people who said, I don't see why I should have to go to petition my local government and be subject to Christian ministers picked by the council itself to send me a religious message. And the court said, oh, but if we interfere with this prayer, we're going to be compromising the free exercise rights of the members of the council. That's what this is about. They have a religious right to hold these prayers and make them part of the official business of government. And it's an extraordinary holding, if you think about it, that now government officials have got free exercise rights that ordinary members of the public lack. So we're seeing this expansion of free exercise and a corresponding reduction in what establishment means, and the end is not yet in sight.
Garrett Epps teaches constitutional law and creative writing for law students at the University of Baltimore. His latest book is American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Professor Epps' article in The Atlantic Magazine, where he is a contributing editor, is titled A Major Church-State Ruling That Shouldn't Have Happened, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. I sure thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's a privilege.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear about the new We Are Six initiative from the National Sikh Campaign Executive Director Gurind Singh Ahuja. And up next, West Virginia pastor and activist Kayla Parker. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Among the many stories early this past week about activists nationwide demanding that their senators take seriously demands not to mindlessly kill Obamacare, it was just one. Six arrested at the offices of West Virginia's Shelley Moore Capito. Kayla Parker is the young pastor of Charleston's Unitarian Universalist Congregation. And she was among those led from the protest in handcuffs. I hope the handcuffs are off, and I welcome you to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for the welcome, and they are indeed off.
That's good. So many Americans, I think, are feeling kind of hopeless right now. What made you think you should take part in this direct protest, knowing you were likely to be arrested?
Yeah, I also have those feelings of deep hopelessness and just kind of overwhelm of what our world has become and what it is right now. And certainly since November, I think a lot of us have had that feeling increase. Mm-hmm. And I honestly was just lucky enough to be a part of a community of folks who care a lot and who are able to be courageous. And I think when I just contemplate the state of the world on my own, it's really easy to be overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. But when I'm in a room with activists and faith leaders and we're all thinking together about what can make a difference, it seems a little easier. And it's easier to say yes to being courageous and taking some risks, because it's not just about me, you know, it's about mm-hmm. the people who I'm accountable with, who I'm engaging with. And I think, honestly, the other thing is just being in my congregation and in my community and hearing really horror stories of how hard people's lives already are and how much harder they would be if this bill had gone into effect. Mm-hmm. From that, any small thing I did just felt so necessary, because I really do feel like it's my role to care for other people, and really I think it's all of our roles to care for other folks. So just living into that connection on a lot of different levels was helpful.
Give us a sense of what happened, how things played out on Monday for you and the group that you were with.
Yeah, so our demand was that Senator Capito take a public stand on voting no on the AHCA bill. So we, you know, went into the senator's office and let their staff know that that's what we were there to do, and just had conversations with her staff and then amongst ourselves and with sort of our audience through a Facebook Live video. We talked about how important it is nationally. You know, the CBE released the number about 22 million folks, but also how important it was for West Virginians particularly. West Virginia was one of the states that was most positively affected and that gained the most insurance through the Affordable Health Care Act. It was 170,000 West Virginians who would have lost their insurance. So we talked about that, and we read stories about health care that we had gathered from the community by canvassing and by having a table at our Pride Parade that happened in Charleston, West Virginia, about a month or two ago.
A part of what makes this story so inspiring is the change of heart Senator Capito has had on this craven health care bill. Did this feel like a victory for you and the other activists there?
Yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag, and we're feeling kind of like we're gaining. You know, it was a step forward for sure, but we also are very aware that in the past, things like this have been delayed, and then they're sort of taken into the even darker corners and pushed through really quickly. So we're both feeling good about being able to get the bill delayed and having her make a public statement about saying no, and are also really aware of the fact that she waited until after it was announced that the bill was being delayed to make a public statement, and that it's, you know, it's very likely that more could be happening with this bill in the future that we'll need to take more action with. But we certainly feel like it's a step in the right direction, and we had a big community potluck dinner last night and, you know, both celebrated and fortified for the resistance ahead.
Why were you arrested?
Technically, we were arrested because we had made the clear statement that we would be staying in Senator Capito's office until she publicly made a statement that she would vote no on this bill. And by the end of the business day, she had not made that statement, and her office is actually in a privately owned building in Charleston. It was the building owner who said, you know, you can't be here past 5. And because we were refusing to leave, we were then subsequently arrested.
I see. Kayla, how does citizen activism intersect with your own ministry in the church?
I mean, I think it just has a lot to do with caring for my congregants. I heard or read about a metaphor once that, you know, in a lot of ways, pastors are kind of gardeners, and we have to care for the individual plants, but we also have to care for the soil that they're growing in. And, you know, sometimes if that soil that the plants or the vegetables or the fruit or whatnot is growing in, it's going to affect all of the plants. So that there are times when we're caring for each individual, and there's time that we're needing to care for the environment that they're in and making sure that that's also healthy. And this was just such a clear example of really needing to be caring for and advocating for the structures that my congregants and my community live in. So for me, it then, you know, the pastoral and the prophetic feel pretty closely intertwined when I think about ministry in that way.
Mm-hmm. Does it frustrate you that so much mainstream coverage of faith-based activism focuses on conservative political Christianity? And I'll tell you, it does me.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem in terms of trying to reclaim what faith is and does in the United States. I am heartened by the fact that as sort of individualized media becomes really the way that a lot of folks are getting media, it does seem like at least folks in my circle know it's happening more, but they're totally true that in the mainstream media, that's religious is denoted with the right, and that's just not true.
Yeah, that's right. I know
that your radio show does a lot of work to try and change that misconception, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. What do you think it will take for progressive voices of faith to more fully take their place at the table?
I think some of it has to do with just making our own tables, you know, and saying, you know, we might not be included in these conversations, but we're going to be showing up and doing the right thing. I think a lot of problems we have of kind of mainstream progressive religion dying is that we, in many cases, chose to be less relevant. So I think any time we can choose to be relevant and to do what we're called to be doing, to care for our people and our world, I think that brings us to the table, or at least it has us creating the table that we're wanting to be at.
We know that progressive voices have not been as strong as they should have been and as numerous as they should have been through some really tough times in the past. And
right.
You're really kind of blazing a new trail there and saying maybe we can do it a different way. And that's why it's important for me to know what you think about it.
Well, I don't know if I can take credit for doing all of that, certainly. And, you know, I've learned how to do anything I'm doing from mentors and senior colleagues who have been fighting this fight for a while. You know, and I also am hopeful that right now and since November, there does seem to be a heightened and deepened awareness of the problems we're facing. And I think you know, more of us, and certainly myself, has been more drawn to be more engaged since then. So my hope comes from that mm-hmm. although it's unfortunate that we are where we are, I think a lot of us, myself included, have woken up a little bit, and you know, we all like to be comfortable. Yeah. And it's hard to live into discomfort and to take risks. And I think in the past several months, and certainly this year, it's become aware that that's really necessary.
Kayla, what would you say to listeners who feel strongly about the moral aspects of what's going on around us, but are hesitant to get involved in fighting for change? Maybe they don't know where to begin. What would you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak about this from very personal experience, because that's where I was just a couple months ago. And for me, it really was about being in relationship with folks who were starting to engage in this work or who have been engaging in this work for a while. So I would say, you know, find the folks in your community who have been fighting the fight for a while, and just show up to a couple meetings or gatherings or actions, events they're doing in a pretty low, you know, low committal, low energy way. It certainly isn't necessary, nor would it actually be appropriate for those of us who are newer to this to kind of jump into the limelight or take a lead role right at the beginning. It's really important to just build relationships with folks who have been in this fight for a while and to learn from them. So I would say do some research on who's doing cool work in your area and just start hanging out with them. And, you know, before you know it, you'll be getting arrested in your senator's office. So.
Kayla Parker is pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Charleston, West Virginia. Last Monday, she was one of six activists arrested at the office of Senator Shelley Moore Capito while protesting Capito's support of the Senate Obamacare repeal bill. After the bill was pulled from consideration, at least for now, the senator announced that she would not support it in its present form. Kayla, thank you for sharing your insights, your humility, and your advice. It's very helpful for us, and we appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
With over 25 million followers worldwide, the Sikh faith is a major world religion. At the same time, American Sikhs face ignorance, hostility, and sometimes even violence. Research shows that a majority of Americans know nothing about their Sikh neighbors, which obviously contributes to the problem. And stepping up to change the situation is the We Are Sikhs initiative from the National Sikh Campaign. I'm joined by Campaign Executive Director Gurwin Singh Ahuja. Gurwin, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Majority of Americans know nothing about the Sikh religion and have never met a Sikh. Would you talk a little more about the challenges these numbers reveal?
The way this lack of knowledge manifests itself into issues is that in many cases, children are bullied. More than half of Sikh children are bullied. In some cases, this lack of knowledge even contributes to death. Some people have been shot or killed or attacked in very brutal situations. And in many cases, the reason why these things are happening is that we look very different. Sikhs wear turbans, they have beards. Many people view turbans and beards based off what they see as something on TV as either anti-American or religious extremism. But what many people don't know is that Sikhs wear turbans and that we have beards to basically symbolize our commitment to the values of equality, religious tolerance, racial equality, gender equality, values that are really core American values. Mm-hmm. And if more people knew that fact, I really feel that some of these attacks wouldn't occur, or some of these kind of daily incidences of bullying and discrimination would not occur. So that's really the impetus of the campaign.
What are some of the other kind of consequences of these high levels of unfamiliarity?
How I think a Sikh kind of internalizes the dynamic that we face, that we are often viewed as, you know, suspicious or as religious extremists, and how we view ourselves and how we view our articles of faith. How we view our articles of faith is we view them as things that are very tightly aligned with American values. Mm-hmm. And we're not being perceived that way. We're being perceived in many ways something that is anti-American. And this dichotomy is quite distressing, like just kind of taking in my own daily life. Like, it is distressing to know that when I walk down the street, people are afraid of me, when if only people knew that the turban that I wear and the beard that I have symbolizes the very values that they hold very dearly.
Mm-hmm. So how is the National Sikh Campaign challenging this situation?
The way we're attacking this is that we want to help spread awareness. Although there are many Sikhs around the world, there are very few in the United States. And we thought the best way to communicate to large numbers of people would be through mass media and grassroots events. We have been working over a period of years with AKPD, which was David Axelrod's firm that worked mm-hmm. on President Obama's campaigns, and they also helped develop his message. We've been working with Heart Research Associates, have worked close with Secretary Clinton in the past, and we've hired another group called FP1 Strategies, which has worked very closely with President Bush. And we've been working together to help craft messages that, you know, our neighbors can understand and really resonate with them about Sikhs and about our community and about our contributions and about our values. And we've been using those messages to communicate with people in three ways. Number one, on television. We've bought a lot of ad time. Number two, online. We've also bought ad space online, and we have a very significant social media presence. And number three, through grassroots events. Just last week, we had a big, major grassroots event in Phoenix, and over 200 non-Sikhs showed up. The mayor showed up. Miss Phoenix beauty pageant contestant showed up. Members of congressional staff showed up and all endorsed the Phoenix Sikh community and the campaign. And for 4th of July in Fresno, we're sponsoring a fireworks show. Their baseball team is holding a Sikh night on July 4th. And across the country, we're asking gurdwaras, which are Sikh temples, to open themselves up and help, again, share our values of equality and religious tolerance.
So what level of change do you think you can drive, and how long is that likely to take?
Well, we are expecting pretty rapid change in our local markets. In Fresno, where we are really focusing a lot of time and effort, we expect a fairly substantial change in awareness in a very tight period of time. And once the campaign and the advertising is completed, we'll be running a post-poll and measuring the specific change that we've created. Mm-hmm.
I wish you would talk about some of the things you would like all Americans to know about Sikhs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The thing that I want people to know about Sikhs the most is really our value of equality. It's really a foundational part of the faith, really even down to our last names. Many of your listeners may notice that many Sikhs have the last name Singh mm-hmm. or Kaur. Mm-hmm. And the founders of the faith gave us those last names to combat against a brutal cultural caste system that was really predetermining people's potential. Mm-hmm. And it was really stifling people's individuals' lives because if they were born into the wrong family, they would never be able to better themselves. And we believe to our deepest core that all people are equal, that all people are equal under the eyes of God, and that your birth should not determine your destiny. And our founders basically did away with last names because, again, your last name would indicate what family we were from and where you were born and again, your potential in life. And we gave everybody the same last name, Singh for males, which means lion, and Kaur for females, which means princess. And we did that so that people would have control over their lives and that your character would determine your potential, not your family. Mm-hmm. And I want to spend a minute talking about Kaur. I mean, we Sikhs also deeply, deeply believe in gender equality. Mm-hmm. We firmly believe men and women are equal. And the reason why females have their own last name, Kaur, to show that they don't have to take their husband's last name, that they are independent of men, and that they are equal to men. The founder of the faith, Guru Nanak, spent his whole life ensuring that women had an equal place in society as men. Because you have to think, 500 years ago when the faith was being founded, in many cases, women were viewed as property. If their husband died, they would have to sacrifice themselves. And he spent his whole life, ensuring that women were viewed as equal and that they could do everything that a man can do. The biggest takeaway that I have is for your audience is that Sikhs believe in equality. Mm. And equality is also a core American value. It's what brings people from all over the world to come and live and work here. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, because of the way we look, people don't always see the connection between Sikh values and American values. Mm-hmm. But people should know that they are tightly aligned.
We have listeners who may be interested in following up on this conversation. How can listeners support this work and follow the National Sikh Campaign, We Are Sikhs, initially?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the best thing your listeners can do is visit our website, wearesikhs.org. Again, it's wearesikhs.org. And just inform yourself. Learn about our values. Learn about who we are. And sign up. You can sign up for the website, and we can follow up with you and plug you into the campaign. And if you're really interested, you can go to our website and find your local Gurdwara or Sikh temple and take a visit. Sikh temples are open to all people from all faiths at all times. And if you go, they'll even make you a fresh vegetarian meal.
And it's very good, I can tell you from experience. Gurwind Singh Ahuja is Executive Director of the National Sikh Campaign. The campaign is working to introduce Americans to their Sikh neighbors with a new initiative titled We Are Sikhs. Gurwind, thanks so much for joining us today on State of Belief Radio, and good luck with your campaign. It is one that needs to be successful.
Thank you so much.
Now, before we go, last week I had the honor of speaking to an international gathering in Vienna, Austria, on the topic of religious freedom. Remarkably, there continues to be an incredible disconnect between how that term is used in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And the thing is, we need those words to mean something real. The American religious political right does not deserve to use them, especially not now. We need the words religious freedom so that we can describe an end to death threats for leaving a faith, something that happens in other parts of the world, not here. We need those words so we have a way of talking about the soaring number of anti-Semitic incidents around the world, and yes, in the United States as well. We need those words so we can describe the opposite of the fear some Muslims feel around the world, and yes, here in the United States as well, if they can even get here after the Supreme Court's ruling this week of just being identified as Muslim in the street or of gathering to pray and to comfort each other. That's what we continue to need those words for, religious freedom. Here at home, despite the president having received an almost unprecedented level of evangelical Christian voter support, despite vast numbers of conservative Christians now holding local, state, and national offices after overtly campaigning in Christianist terms, despite signals from the Supreme Court that the separation of church and state may no longer apply to Christian institutions, despite one-party rule in Washington, D.C. and promises to enact a raft of political religious right agenda items, the narrative of victimization continues unabated. It is incredible. It is as if being asked to obey the Constitution is equal to persecution. I just saw a fundraising letter from the ironically named Family Research Council claiming straight out that Barack Obama is holed up in a Washington mansion and is somehow pulling strings to thwart the Christianist agenda. So send Tony Perkins money, ASAP, because Christians are under attack. You'll hear the same victim narrative from other multimillion-dollar far-right operations claiming, despite all evidence to the contrary, that they are under assault right now, right here. If ever you doubted that anti-gay cake baker defenders, Ten Commandment monument erectors, Happy Holidays wisher critiquers were in it for the money, as we've often implied on this program, there's never been better evidence of that truth. Everything has changed, except the victim narrative, the solution to which seems to be always send us money. Complaining about religious oppression when there is no religious oppression brings to mind words that can actually be found on those Ten Commandments monuments we've been hearing so much about. Thou shalt not lie. Well, it's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound?